The following is a production of BYU Broadcasting in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.
Oh, I march to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. And there were mellower things like, show me a prison. Show me a jail. Show me a prisoner whose face has grown pale.
Today leaves us a lot to think about. Exactly 40 years ago, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Aside from the commemoration of the single day, the 4th of April, 1968 as a whole has been called the year that made us who we are. Newsweek writer Jonathan Darman has said, "All of us are stuck in the 60s, hostages to a decade we define ourselves as for or against." Just why was 68 so big? What is the cultural legacy of that crucial year in American history? And why might you want to attend a recital tonight to commemorate the day and the year? Answers coming up on today's Thinking Aloud. On a day like today, I think we've got just the right people for our program. I'd like to welcome Philip Snyder. Philip Snyder completed his doctoral work at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's taught at BYU since 1988, specializes in 20th century British and American literature, and studies in autobiography. Phil teaches courses treating regional and ethnic American literature, specifically Southern and Western literature. Just last semester, he taught an English course titled America in the 60s. And in that course, the students surveyed texts, ideas, attitudes, songs, history, and culture from that very socially turbulent and politically turbulent decade. Phil's enthusiasm for and expertise in the subject matter is supplemented by the fact that he is a native Californian, and certainly California had a big role to play in the 60s. He's a natural for Thinking Aloud today, and Phil Snyder, welcome.
Thank you.
And Michael Hicks returns to Thinking Aloud today, not as a composer-songwriter in the spotlight, per se. During our last interview with him, he was. But today, he's a commentator on the 60s. He comes from the BYU School of Music faculty. Long before that, he hails from the Bay Area in San Francisco. That California qualification crops up again here today. Some of his formative experiences in his teens were inescapably connected with the California zeitgeist of unrest, protest, and particularly what I like to call or think of as musical political oratory. Tonight at BYU, he's going to be performing a recital, perhaps unplugged, but certainly plugged into the 60s. It's a recital billed as Mike Hicks at the Madsen Recital Hall, Folk Songs from the 1960s. And, of course, occasioning the recital, which includes material specific to the Martin Luther King Jr. story, is today's anniversary, 40 years today, since the assassination of Dr. King. Mike Hicks, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm going to ask the big question first, which has to do with the way we've decided to configure the discussion today. We're going to focus, I suppose, in part on the year 1968. It seems that 68 may have been the apex of this era as far as political activism, cultural activism. What was going on apart from, obviously, the assassination of both King and Bobby Kennedy? What was going on that made 68 stand out? Phil Snyder.
Well, I think the first event that's of significance is the Tet Offensive that started at the end of January of that year. And it demonstrated to everyone that the Vietnam War was not going as well as the Johnson administration had led the country to believe. And I think that was a direct cause of 2 months later, President Johnson announcing to the country that he would not seek the Democratic nomination for president. And I think he finished his presidency sort of a broken man because Vietnam had ruined all his hopes and aspirations for the Great Society, the transforming civil rights legislations and so forth. I think another really important focusing event is the Democratic National Convention during the summer in Chicago and all the violence and protests and social unrest that was associated with that. The very worst of the protesters was very clear and obvious. The very worst of the establishment Mayor Richard Daley and all of his police and National Guard and so forth. In addition, all throughout the 60s, there were a number of students protests on campuses, Columbia, Berkeley, University of Wisconsin, protesting against Dow Chemical. All but BYU. There were no protests. There were no protests
during
68.
None of record, right?
None on record, at least, yeah.
Well, I want to know, we're going to hear from Mike Higgs in just a second, but I want to know, Phil, where were you? About how old were you? You and I are not same generation.
I was 15, and my father was a history political science professor at Fullerton College, and as I say, I was old enough to be aware of everything that was going on in the 60s, but not old enough to get really in much trouble. And I remember campaigning for Eugene McCarthy.
Did you just say that regretfully?
Well, no. Always a good Mormon boy, but I was really caught up in this notion of civil rights legislation, this notion of equality, very much against the Vietnam War. I felt that I was more well aware of exactly what was going on than my fellow students in Orange County, a very, very conservative place. My friends and I would go around campaigning for Gene McCarthy. He's really the first politician who went out against the Vietnam War. I think Robert Kennedy picked that up a little bit later, and eventually everyone except George Wallace took an anti-war stance. We'd even go to Wallace headquarters and pretend to gather a bunch of Wallace literature and then throw it in the trash can to try and circumvent his campaign. I went to protests, Cal State Fullerton, Fullerton College. It was a heady time. I thought that I was just right on the edge of protest and on the edge of, I guess, the great society that President Johnson had envisioned.
Mike Higgs, by comparison, first that question, and you can answer it any way you choose, but why 68 such a pivotal thing, aside from what Phil has already mentioned? And then we want to know, where were you, about how old were you during this time period?
Well, I'm a little bit younger. I was 12 in 68. I was in junior high, but I was in an environment where there was a lot of pamphleteering and demonstrating and but, you know, several things that Phil said jogged my mind. First of all, one thing that a lot of younger listeners – I don't know if there are younger listeners to KBYU-FM actually, but one thing they may not really recognize is that the draft was on young people's mind. And so, you know, when you're in high school in 68 – and these things are going on in Vietnam and have been going on for some years, you are seeing yourself as someone who may well be there within 2-3 years, and you may have siblings or other relatives who have gone and lost a lot, maybe lost their lives. And we're so detached as a culture from that requirement for service now. And so I think a lot of people don't understand the complete envelopment in the protesting of the war or support of the war if you supported it. But for young people, a lot of the protesting had to do with their own awareness of their lives or their friends or their families' lives being sacrificed for a cause that people really wondered about and questioned and a lot of people didn't believe in or were scratching their head about. So that's one thing to mention. It's not particular to 1968, but 1968, as Phil said, was a year that around the world there were protests of Vietnam and other social situations and protests against repression in governments generally. A lot of things in Europe taking place, and it's just seen as a pivotal year for many people. For me, it was a pivotal year just because junior high is a pivotal year, you know, entering junior high for many people. But I actually, as I mentioned to you earlier, was in a talent show in junior high and played a couple of songs that I'll be playing on my recital that were anti-war songs. And one of them in particular, the I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die rag, which is best known perhaps for its presence at Woodstock and in the film Woodstock, these got me disqualified. I was just sort of taken off the roster when they did the judging.
Never made it to the stage?
No, I performed them, and there were enough complaints from parents about, you know, this young person doing these things in a public forum.
Well, that, good for you. I mean, you won a talent contest, as far as I'm concerned. Disqualification is an honorable thing.
It was the greatest qualification in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I dressed up even in army fatigues, and I had a partner who was playing with me on ukulele, and he was wearing an Uncle Sam outfit. Hmm. And so that was part of the inflammation
right
of it. But you know what's odd is that I didn't even see it as being radical or provocative. It just seemed to me, of course, this is what you sing and you're performing. And I was actually amazed at the other kinds of sort of Broadway-ish material that musically other people were doing, because that just wasn't my world at all. And I didn't have a Mormon upbringing. I was brought up in the Baptist church. And, you know, the Christian community, the evangelical Baptist Pentecostal community with which I was involved very much as a teenager later on, were just inextricably linked with the civil rights movement. And a lot of the folk songs, one in particular that will be the closing song of this recital, All My Trials, which was, I only discovered later on, a great sort of anthem of student sit-ins and so on. That was something that we sang in church. And that's where I learned it, was in Bible study groups. So
that's an early form of crossover.
Yeah, it was crossover. So that was my experience, a little bit different, partly because of my social upbringing in Christianity, but also, I don't know, an outlook that I picked up maybe from friends, and I was really into various media. You know, I was around when the first issue of Rolling Stone came out.
Were you really just into the music, or was there a part of you that, I know it might be just, you know, 40 years is a long time, and maybe you don't quite remember what it was like. Was there not a little scintilla in you at that time that wanted to protest in that talent show?
Well, oh yeah, I wanted to protest. It just seemed to me odd that no one else seemed to be doing the same. But my brother had gone to Vietnam in 65 and was wounded and had a Purple Heart and so on, and he had sacrificed a lot. And he seemed very young. And my brother, to this day, and he's 10 years older than I, and he still has nightmares about the war. He still has great depression and so on, mm-hmm. Psychological detriments from his war experience, which was relatively short.
This is radio, and so folks can't see right now. You have a good guitar on your lap right there. And I'm wondering if you give us a sneak preview of, you mentioned the song title. Maybe we can go back to 68 and that talent show. Is there something you could share with us?
Well, the nicer song was Draft Dodger Rag, and I mentioned the draft, and this is a great Phil Oakes song. This one, I'll just sing you a little bit of it. I'm just a typical American kid from a typical American town. I believe in God and Senator Dodd and keeping old Castro down. And when it came my time to serve, I knew better dead than red. But when I got down to my old draft board, brother, this is what I said. Sarge, I'm only 18, I got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. I got eyes like a bat, and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Well, think of my career, my sweetheart dear, and my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool. I'm a going to school, and I'm a working in a defense plant. And that's the great song, you know. And a lot of these songs were comical; they were spoofing. But underneath the song, or behind the song, was often a lot of rage and bitterness, and it was transformed into this sort of satirical language. And I think that satire really came of age in the '60s. Too, wouldn't you say, Phil?
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, I'm interested, as I hear that, it calls to mind, if you start looking at the cultural legacy of the 60s, if you start thinking about what we've inherited from the 60s, those songs sort of foregrounded textual concerns in a way that had to be, I suppose, because of their function as protest songs, as well as just being good listening and funny. Is that a real stamp on the music of the 60s, that the text is in the foreground?
Well, I think that it's absolutely essential. And I think as you look back in the folk tradition out of which I think a lot of these protest songs come, the melodies, the tune, have been out there for a long, long time. They're very adaptable to various lyrics. And the other thing that's important is all sorts of people covered this. Everybody wanted to get a guitar. Everyone wanted to be able to sing these songs. All My Trials, We Shall Overcome, all the Blowing in the Wind. And the popular musical groups at that time, they also all covered. There was a repertoire of protest songs that were sung at all the protests and concert halls, or on records, not played too much on popular singles, sort of top 100 radio show, but also all my friends that had a guitar, they'd be playing them too. And in that way, they were disseminated throughout the culture, particularly the youth culture during the 60s.
You know, as you talk about youth culture and the dissemination of this cultural material, I think that, and earlier, Mike, you alluded to the idea that maybe today, the youth of today don't really understand what the zeitgeist was in the 60s. But if there is no draft, and yet people are going to Iraq, the temperature is certainly vastly different from the 60s. There is just not that boiling over cauldron of anti-war sentiment. And so as I think about that, I think, wow, we live in this age where the dissemination of this material could happen just like lightning fire everywhere with the internet, with MP3, with the iPods. And how did that dissemination really take place across the nation, given the fact that you say that some of the top stations were playing the top 100 were staying away from that material? Any thoughts there?
Well, you know, I thought when we came into the studio today, I immediately thought, this is so odd because we're talking about the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King, and as you mentioned, Bobby Kennedy too. But this is sort of the 40th anniversary of FM radio and of stereo. I mean, FM became the underground radio of those days, and really it was 67, 68 when that was happening, and the same with stereo, although stereo isn't a big feature of what we're talking about. But FM, you had, first of all, you know, I'm tempted to sort of answer your question this way because that was the FM sound, the DJ. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very relaxed, mellow, semi-sedated sound. But even the notion of FM was, it was a sort of a hidden bandwidth, and underground radio was the word for it.
But it was the open door for this kind of material to be spread.
A lot of it, yeah. That's where I remember hearing a lot of things that I wouldn't hear on AM Top 40 radio. Extended songs, the psychedelic era material that was really new music, but also this other music that musically, as Phil said, was pretty old, but the lyrics and the language, the satire, the protest and so on often came to us through FM radio. So I find it kind of fun that here we are doing, you know, there used to be a KBYU AM before there was KBYU FM, and they played Top 40 records.
Can we go back just for a second to the idea of the comic element in some of these lyrics? Mm-hmm. Were there protest ballad songs that were just angry and didn't avail themselves of that sort of distancing capacity of humor?
Well sure. I the first one that I think of is Bob Dylan's Masters of War. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people covered that song, and that's a pretty angry song against the military industrial complex. And I just want to add too that that's not to say that these protest songs, this folk protest movement, was not seen on your regular channels, the network TV. Mm-hmm. Hootenanny on Saturday Night was a very, very popular show. That's where I heard a lot of these great folk singers, you know, the Limelighters, Kingston Trio, Brothers Four, Odetta. You know, we can go on and on and on as far as that's concerned.
It really wasn't then just news coverage of the sit-ins where you got to hear these songs. You got to hear them performed as entertainment.
Oh, you got to hear them everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes they tended to be the more milder ones. I think how can I put this? The network executives weren't as prescient as far as intuiting what some of these songs were actually
It hasn't changed much.
Really,
it's still a numbers game. How many people are listening?
Yeah, and then you had a lot of groups like the band, like the Byrds, that would cover Dylan tunes and do it in a little different different way with that Roger McGuinn, that Rickenbacker. Mm-hmm. 12-string electric, doing Mr. Tambourine Man, Bells of Rimini, Chimes of Freedom.
Turn, 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 the Pete Seeger piece.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was out there. And if you were tuned in and had a sense of what was going on, the message came through.
Yeah, there was the whole folk era that then sort of transmuted into rock through Bob Dylan at Newport, going electric and all that with the band that you mentioned. And I remember, you talk about protest songs, and there were anti-war protest songs, but there was a lot of cultural critique too. I remember hearing the song "Little Boxes," sung by Pete Seeger in '63, all the time on the air, and I didn't really know quite what it was about until my father on the Bayshore Freeway pointed up at the houses in Daly City on the hillside there, and only later did I understand, after being educated, what the other little boxes meant.
I'm going to invite you to elaborate on that in just a second. Maybe play a snatch of that for us. Thinking Aloud today, we have guests Mike Hicks from the BYU School of Music and Philip Snyder. Today is April 4th of 2008. That puts us exactly 40 years to the day since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Marking that event here on the BYU campus, Mike Hicks will be performing at the Madison Recital Hall folk songs from the 1960s, and tonight at 9:30 on the BYU campus, Little Boxes. Help us out understand what that's about. You say social commentary or critique.
Well, the song starts out talking about little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, and little boxes, they're all the same. And then he says there's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one and so on. And so it's the literal suburban configuration on the hillside, but then it goes into
subdivision development protests.
Against the suburbs. But then the next verse is, and the people in the houses all go to the universities where they all get put in boxes, little boxes, and they all come out the same and so on. So there's that aspect of it. And, that sort of cultural critique is really part of definitely California culture. A lot of Berkeley and Stanford, these were the places where these ideas about freedom in education and the sort of destruction of a traditional curriculum and the pursuit of more wide-ranging ideas, I think, comes about. And so you hear it in songs like that. That was a Malvina Reynolds song. Pete Seeger did it. And I don't know that it was a hit, really, but it was on the air a lot in those days, and that was back in '63.
Strum a little, sing a little.
Oh. Well, let's see. I've got to get the right key here. I do it with a capo, which I don't have here today, but little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. Anyway, that's a different key that I'd already played in, but
I'd like to ask you both making the connection 40 years back to the present day. Oftentimes there has been the notion that art can be dangerous. There are those who see art as being ornament, decoration. It's beautiful. You think of the old idea of a purple-haired lady in a nice gallery seeing bouquets of flowers. Mm-hmm. And yet, how would you situate the 60s in terms of ramping up on the danger of art? And how is are we left now with that imprint? I don't know that it's unique to the 60s by any means. I'm sure art was used in dangerous ways before. Sure. But any thoughts there? Phil Snyder. And I should mention, too, Phil Snyder from the English department and teaches course on the 60s.
Well, I think that art's always been dangerous. And if we divide periods of literary movements, periods of movement in art, it's always revolutionary. Artists like to be in the avant-garde. They really do, whether it's Armut's fountain, the urinal, and whether it's the British Romantic poets who oppose the neoclassical senses of order and closed couplet and so forth. Art's always been that way.
Well, I'm wondering, though, if as the crest of the wave of the 60s, 68, comes along, if the vehicle of art for an artist to be a provocateur, that was an easy open window. I'm wondering if that has subsided in the interim.
I would say absolutely not. I was just thinking, for instance, about Katrina and the Bush administration's handling of New Orleans, and what that revealed to us about race and economic condition. REM has a song called Houston, just out on their brand new CD Accelerator. Mary Chapin Carpenter, multi Grammy winner, has a song called Houston. Dixie Chicks made a comment at a concert in London about being ashamed of George W. Bush, a fellow Texan. There were protests, CD burning with country stations all over the country. They came back on their next album with a song about I'm Not Ready to Make Nice. Mary Chapin Carpenter, on her most recent CD, The Calling, has a song dedicated to the Dixie Chicks, really so lashing out against what has traditionally been a country music artist's main audience. I don't give a damn is basically what Mary Chapin Carpenter says literally. It's alive and well.
Well, I guess my thoughts here are just I'm wondering if Pandora's box opened in the 60s is a good metaphor, a good analogy for now. We're in somehow the 60s left us with greater latitude for this kind of political, rhetorical expression. And there's no going back, at least in America. We're living in a day and age where a public protest in some countries gets shut down immediately. And now we have this heritage in America from the 60s that this is actually not only permissible, it's encouraged. It all has to do with freedom of speech and all of those issues. Pandora's box, Mike, is that...
A Pandora's box or a treasure chest, depending on your point of view.
Yeah.
But, I'm just... this is directly answering your question. I'm just reflecting on what Phil was saying. And we have this notion of the avant-garde, and we think of that as being sort of extreme and sort of fantastic in some way. But the avant-garde is really originally was a military term, and it was the vanguard of an advancing army. And going back to the 60s, that great record label was Vanguard. That was one of the great labels. And so the consciousness that always, as musicians, at least when you're singing, you might be on the front end of some kind of battle, I think, was there then. And maybe there was a consciousness that certainly came to the minds of Americans at that time.
Because you have a recital tonight, this conversation can go on. It will go on tonight.
Yep.
Thank you both for participating today. We want to make known Mike Hicks at the Madison Recital Hall tonight at 9:30, singing folk songs from the 1960s. Thanks for being with us, Mike Hicks.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Philip Snyder, from the English Department
at
BYU.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
By the way, when Mike Hicks performs tonight, you'll get double your money for attending for two reasons. Because he'll be using a 12-stringed guitar instead of the mere 6 strings you're hearing now. And because the recital has no admission charge. It's free. For information about the recital and about Thinking Aloud, just come to our website, classical89.org.
Hush, little baby, don't you cry. You know your papa was born to die.